This is the current federal tax developments here for the week of August the 22nd, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. Now, this week, things look a little different and will be a little different, so it's going to sound a bit different, too, because I am on the road. I am doing this from the Hilton Garden Inn outside the airport in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm just finishing up doing some sessions here in Columbus. And I'll be heading back out to Phoenix later today, so we're going to hopefully get this recorded here. But it does mean I don't have my regular setup for recording. That includes my audio, so I'm using a USB microphone here and my regular audio setup. And my video setup is using a camera that is on a ThinkPad T420S, which not exactly the world's greatest audio-video production machine out there, but you know, ThinkPads weren't really designed for that. So we'll just take a look and go forward. But we're going to take a look at our developments this week, including being reasonable, which is the key issue that we're running into here, trying to make sure that our taxpayers are reasonable in how they handle the tax issues. We're going to get two taxpayers out of penalties because they had reasonable cause. Now, the current federal tax developments, as always, are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. You want to be sure and take a look there at your State Society's offerings. We're going to this week be looking at a number of interesting and odd cases. So as I said, we're going to start out this week looking at the problem that a taxpayer had who apparently hadn't yet got their business started. We'll next look at some problems of changing an accounting method, including one where maybe the IRS probably shouldn't have raised the question, but they did, and they won, but they probably didn't get tax money out of the win. So for the IRS, that's probably not a positive. We also had an email that discussed the problems that we run into or potential problems. We have adult companions and how that works and how we can end up with an employment tax liability for an adult companion in that scenario. We took a look as well at a partnership that got out of a late filing penalty because it did not have access to any reasonable data for preparing its return. So we'll talk about that particular fact pattern and how the situation worked. We'll also go on and talk about a not-for-profit corporation and its interest, the interest rates, finding out that it is going to get clipped for being a large corporation, which probably is not something it's happy with, but it's clipped as a large corporation, and so we'll be stuck with the large corporation rules. And then we'll also take a look at the end here of a taxpayer who made a mistake in determining which year deduction should be taken, so therefore she didn't file a return, believing she had no tax liability to worry about. And the tax court actually agreed that she had reasonably basically been confused, and so we'll talk about that. Now, this is the time of year we have a few courses coming up here before the September 15th extension due dates, where we have all those corporate returns and partnership returns and all the other neat things that are September. So I have a few courses coming up. Monday, which is when this is released, I'll be doing a session on ethics and quality control and tax practice in Phoenix, both a webcast and a live session. Wednesday and Thursday of the week, August 24th and 25th, I'll have courses in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for the New Mexico Society of CPAs, first one on construction contractors, special tax and accounting considerations, and then corporate taxation, subchapter C for CNS corporations. I'll do that one on Thursday. Then we'll take a little bit of time off. We'll go September 7th and 8th. I'll be going to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I will be doing a fringe benefits course in Cedar Rapids on September 7th, and I'll be doing a new course for us, real estate partnerships, getting in, getting out, and getting taxed in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on September the 8th. So if you're available, you want to come to one of those courses, be sure and head over there, and we'll be really glad to see you as you come up for those courses. Now let's start taking a look at what's actually happening this week in the area of taxes. We've got a few cases to go with, and our first case is a case of Tizard versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2016-42 that was issued on August the 15th. The taxpayer in this case was a pilot for a major commercial airline, and she was nearing her retirement age. So she went out and she bought an aircraft that she was going to use for purposes of training people, and which she was also going to be using potentially for doing some aerial photography. So she had this plane. She acquired one she wanted. She picked it up. She got it here in late part of 2010. Now, in 2010, at the time she was looking to buy the plane, she had discussions with the seller, and the seller was planning to do some development in the area where the taxpayer lived. And the seller, you know, discussed with her having her do some aerial photography in the plane. Now, she claims they had an oral agreement to have this go forward, but they never actually ended up signing a contract, and she never actually did any of the work. Once she got the plane, she did take an acquaintance on a flight for what she called an incentive orientation flight on the day the aircraft was delivered to her. And that particular flight, she invoiced that flight, but she didn't actually give the invoice to her acquaintance, and she never collected on it. The acquaintance left the state and never actually became a client of hers. Finally, she did post on her Facebook page an announcement when she acquired the plane, saying it was a dream of a lifetime, etc. And she got 50 likes from her 230 Facebook followers. But that particular post never mentioned that she was actually planning to offer training in the plane or use it for business. She later would open up in 2014 a Facebook page for her business operation, but it was hacked early on and shut down, and she didn't actually reestablish a Facebook presence until another 3 years later. After all of this, she claimed losses of just over $13,000 for the year in 2010. She had no revenue in 2010, and what I told you seems to be basically her business activities, per the opinion. The tax court found that, in fact, she had a little problem here. She hadn't actually started her trade or business by this point. The problem being that you have to actually have a trade or business, which is where the key of this comes down, in order to claim these deductions. So to claim deductions for starting a trade or business, you have to have one. If the business has not actually started, you end up with having to capitalize these under Section 195, and your deduction will only be allowed later if you can show under Section 195 that the business has started, and then you get up to $5,000 if you haven't spent more than $50,000 on as immediate write-off, and the remaining balance of write-off will be amortized over 180 months. But she'd done neither in 2010, so all the expenses she'd incurred, the court and the IRS agreed that she intended this to be for business, but the court and the IRS also said, sorry, we're not going to consider you yet in a trade or business, and because of that, you can't yet claim a deduction. Next up, a change of accounting method case. This is a case of Nebecker versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-155. This is an interesting case. August 16th is when the tax court brought it down. The taxpayer in question did projects under contract, and he hired some contractors, you know, independent contractors, to work with him on these service contracts. He did a lot of them for government agencies, and he was required to account for each contract for all the expenses he had incurred. Now, initially, he's on the cash basis of accounting. And when he started this business, he would write off every time he paid a contractor, he wrote off what he paid, traditional cash basis accounting. Somewhat later after starting, a couple years after starting, he changed. Because he had to match these payments, he had to match these expenses for contractors with the contracts, he began to hold them and not deduct the payment until he actually invoiced on the contract in question, which could be from 90 days to 6 months after, essentially, he had finished the job, or he basically had incurred the contracting expense. So we have a little issue here. Now, his CPA had apparently endorsed this, we were told. Maybe the CPA believed he had to do it that way because he had a right of reimbursement. Maybe the CPA just believed it was optional. It would make more sense. It was simpler. And maybe the CPA simply decided it didn't really matter because would the IRS ever object to delaying deductions? Well, the IRS did. And what the IRS agent claimed was that this was just improper under cash basis. It's an error. So all of those deductions he took on his tax return, effectively for the year under exam were paid in the prior year, we're going to disallow. And we'll allow you the deductions for the payments you paid during the year, which I have to assume in the exam were less than the amount he was picking up from the prior year. So they're going to assess him, and those payments for the prior year would never be deducted. The prior year was closed, and the current year had the problem that, you know, we didn't get them this year. So we would never get those deductions. Even if the prior year wasn't closed, we're still going to eventually hit the point at which we have a closed year that we're not going to be able to use. We're going to lose some deductions. The taxpayer first argued it was an acceptable method. The tax court agreed with the IRS that this was not an acceptable method for a taxpayer on a tax basis of accounting, cash basis of accounting. And the court also said it really didn't matter because he never had permission to change his accounting method. Remember, an accounting method is anything that affects the timing but not the amount of a deduction. In this case, what we affected was when we claimed the deduction, we didn't make any change to how much of a deduction we would claim. So because of that, effectively, what we have here is an accounting method. Okay, fine, but here's the catch and why the IRS wasn't arguing it's accounting method. If it's an accounting method, what we have to end up doing is picking up the income and treating the accounting method, picking up the adjustment, beginning in the year in which we make the change. So the IRS is going to have to allow him to claim his deductions for the year under exam, the ones he wouldn't have claimed. But then they're also going to, under 41, have to begin to take into account the fact that he had deductions that would never be claimed because there were deductions that would not have been claimed under his old method, but should have been claimed under his new method year to date. That negative adjustment has to be taken into account and allowed as a deduction under 41A. So in reality, what the IRS is going to end up with is actually allowing him deductions. You're going to allow him to start deducting items earlier than he had been, arguing that that's his required method of accounting, and he's been set on that method by the IRS. Probably not what the agent thought was going to happen, but definitely what's required to happen, because there's little question. What we have here is an accounting method. And as an accounting method, we're just kind of stuck with having to, you know, get permission to change. And while the IRS can set him back, they have to allow a 41A adjustment. That simply is not an option. Next up, we have a chief counsel email, 2016-33034, issued on August 12th. This looks at the employment status of adult companions. Are adult companions employees or independent contractors? And who are they an employee of? They're an employee of anybody. Well, the IRS was trying to set up some training materials is where this thing comes from. You read this email. And they're discussing there is a special rule under Section 3506A that actually holds that a companion placement service is not generally going to be considered the employer of a person they place unless they choose to treat them as employees, which they generally won't. So there'll be a commission. You'll get it through the agency, but the agency doesn't treat these people as employees. The question then became, are they independent contractors or are they employees of the adult who they're assisting? Adult companions, you know, basically to understand the concept here, we're talking about the type of people who may come in where you have a, let's say, like an elderly individual who needs some assistance in day-to-day operations, but doesn't need the medical care of a skilled nursing facility or any other type of, you know, location where there'd be medical personnel on hand at all times. They just need some help during the day. So we have this adult companion. Well, the email concludes that the adult companion could be an independent contractor or it could be an employee. It depends upon whether the adult who's receiving these services has the right to direct the activities of the companion. If they do, if they're in control, it's a standard employment test. These people are household employees of that person. They're definitely not employees of the agency they got them from, which is probably what a lot of them would assume, or a lot of tax preparers would assume who haven't looked at that code section. But the catch is they're not there. They could still be employees. And if they're employees, they're going to be employees of the adult who's being assisted. And if that's true, that's the one who has to file the payroll tax information as a household employee. He's going to have to do all of that reporting. Something to be aware of. Now, again, this is an email. It's like all of these sorts of emails. It's one of those things that is what the IRS informally is stating internally. But it is something that apparently they're thinking of putting into their training there. So don't be surprised if agents start trying to enforce this thing. One of those things they just might decide to try to do. Next up, we have the case of INRI REFCO Public Community Pool Limited Partnership. This is a bankruptcy court for the District of Delaware, case number 14-11216. The citation in the American Federal Tax Reporter is 118 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2016-5085. The opinion came down on August the 2nd of 2016. Now, this particular partnership is looking to be excused from over $3.6 million worth of penalties for filing their partnership returns late. Again, it's bankruptcy, and they hadn't filed returns. There's no question returns had not been filed, so that's not really the issue. The question is going to come up is, you know, is the IRS going to be able to collect that $3.6 million? Now, this particular partnership, there's a long story, and it's kind of interesting to read the case, but they had invested all of their assets with an organization that had a series of groups of various investment pools they were working with. And these were apparently structured as partnerships. And so all of their assets were effectively in this secondary partnership. Now, the problem is this organization is located in the Cayman Islands. And it turned out that at some point it was discovered that there was a little bit of an accounting problem here. The first one they discovered was that they hadn't disclosed that they had a lot of related party receivables that were on the books and misclassified. Okay, that's a bit of a panic because, hey, you know, suddenly we gave them money, then they went and borrowed it out and used it themselves. That kind of sounds bad. So a lot of the people who had invested said, I want my money back. Well, that caused a run on the organization that threw it into bankruptcy. One of the groups that said we want our money back is this particular REFCO Public Community Pool Partnership. Well, when they did, they didn't get their money back. They got special interest units. So basically these partnership units. But then shortly after that, this organization had to file for protection under the laws of the Cayman Islands because obviously there was a run on the bank effectively, and they couldn't pay all these people off. Well, they had a receiver appointed, and when the receiver got in, we went from bad to worse on the accounting problems. The receiver discovered that effectively the accounting records were garbage. In fact, what they told us was we didn't even really know. They didn't even break things down between the various accounts, so they didn't even know what really was each one of these sub-partnerships should have owned. They had statements of sorts for the group as a whole, no detail for the broken down for the parts for each section, but each one of those statements went out stating, we know these are wrong, you should not rely upon them, they should not be used for any purpose. They also never prepared partnership returns, and at the end of the day, they actually found that it would cost so much to actually do partnership returns that they just announced they weren't doing them, and they got a settlement with the IRS took care of that problem for them. Now we're looking at our partnership, which is the one that had, you know, was getting no K-1s. The only information it had, they were told, was wildly unreliable. Our partnership did not file any tax returns either. And the partnership's defense was, the only information we got is wrong. We have no information on the investment we made. And, you know, if we do anything and we wildly guess, we're going to be way off. And we're either going to be in trouble with the IRS for having misstated low our income, or we're going to be wildly in trouble with our partners who will sue us because we overstated their income, and that could cause them all kinds of problems. So they hadn't filed returns. The IRS said, sorry, guys, you should have filed returns. The tax court, and basically in this case, the bankruptcy court, agreed with the partnership. They said, in this case, and it's a very specific fact pattern, it was reasonable not to file the returns. That was a reasonable move for the partnership. They had a real risk. They knew anything they did would be wildly wrong. They decided simply not to file. The court found that that was reasonable cause and did not treat this as a situation where the IRS could collect that penalty in bankruptcy. It's important to understand that that's a very unique fact pattern. This will not excuse a taxpayer who says, hey, I don't have perfect information, because, by the way, none of us ever do. And secondly, oh, I'm missing a K-1. That also won't do it if that K-1 is not basically your entire investment portfolio. It's a unique fact case, and it is a case out of a bankruptcy court, which you also have to remember. You know, you're not probably going to be in front of that court. But it is a case that says, you know, you have to look at reasonable cause possibilities and sometimes consider they might be there. I wouldn't really want to rely on this case for front-end planning, but it might be useful to try to back the IRS down if you have a really, really bad fact. If you have a situation where your facts are, they're just, the information was wildly unreliable for no reason under the control of the taxpayer, then you may have a chance. This case suggests that at least the bankruptcy court saw that as reasonable cause. Next up, we have a case here, the United States versus Detroit Medical Center. This is a Sixth Circuit case, case number 15-1279, issued on August the 17th of this week. This is a case dealing with interest being paid on an overpayment of payroll taxes. This organization is a 501c3 corporation. It had a overpayment of payroll taxes. It argued that, or it, you know, it basically, so it got its refund and it looked and it got interest on the refund, but it looked at the computation of interest and said, wait, that you're using the large corporate lower rate. We're not a large C corporation. We should get our refund as a not-for-profit at the regular rate for non-corporate taxpayers or non-large corporate taxpayers. At the district court level, they lost that claim. It was thrown out. And the Sixth Circuit also threw that claim out. Now, it's going to go through an analysis of a bunch of cross-references in Code Section 6621. But what the court found was that there is a reference, if you bury it, follow the cross-references far enough, you'll see the word C corporation. But the court found that that was not dealing with the definition of who would be subject to the penalty, but rather dealt more with time periods that are involved for potential penalties, and said that in reality, you know, time periods for income taxes, and this would never be an income tax. The court held that all corporations, no matter if they are C corps or not, so that would include 501c3 corporations and S corporations, are subject to the interest, the large corporation interest rate rules on underpayments and overpayments. Now, obviously, generally for a not-for-profit, we're primarily probably looking at payroll tax overpayment situations or potentially underpayment. So we'd have the large corporate rates impact there. Because obviously, we would not normally be paying income taxes. We could pay, I guess, the unrelated business income tax. So that would apply too. But generally, not the other issues. The court held this is the way it should be done. The Sixth Circuit now is agreeing with a similar holding, identical holding that we had in the Second Circuit that held the same, that not-for-profit organizations are subject to the large corporate rules. So basically, the large corporate rules are going to impact that entity. So it'll be interesting. Keep that up, you know, kind of see where we're going. But be aware that we have that issue. We have two circuits now on board. I suspect, unless we get another circuit to break quickly, that this will probably be deemed the treatment across the country. Certainly the IRS is going to hold it as a treatment that applies across the country, whether or not your client may believe that's what should happen. And the question is, does your client really want to go to their circuit, assuming they're not in the Second or Sixth Circuit, to try to get this resolved? Well, let's go to some more good news for a taxpayer here. This is the Rogers case, Rogers versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-152, issued on August 15th. This deals with another reasonable cause for late filing of a tax return, this time for an individual return subject to those penalties. Ms. Rogers, she had a really bad run of luck. In 2006, a fire broke out in her apartment and basically, you know, destroyed lots of stuff in the apartment and forced her to shut down the business she was running from the apartment because she had no place to run the business any longer. You know, where she moved into, she wasn't able to run the business. Then in 2007, she was back in the apartment, which apparently had no power. She had candles because she was packing things up to take to storage. And the court doesn't say the candles started things on fire, but nevertheless, a fire broke out while she was there. So potentially it appears the candles might be a problem. And we have another big fire, more damages to her apartment. Things get bad for her because a local newspaper catches up on this. Now, first, the city now has ordered her not to go back in that apartment until they say it's okay for somebody to live in, so she's banned from entering the place. Then the second problem is that the local newspaper picks this up and writes an unflattering story about her two fires. You can imagine what they implied about her. And the neighbors weren't thrilled with her. She had to move into a YWCA. And she had trouble with the other people there at the YWCA and the board. And the police were called for certain incidents. And she found the whole living space dehumanizing. At the same time, she was then trying to get paid by the insurance company for damages to her apartment. She was trying to get additional payments for 2007. She continued to try to do this, apparently, until 2009, when she basically finally settled everything up. And per the settlement, it became clear that she really had no reasonable basis for additional funds even back in 2007. So this is our background. Now, because of this, she had filed returns every year like clockwork. She always did her own returns. She did her own tax research. She would call the IRS. She would go read publications, read documents to try to assess her tax liability. And this worked fine for her. She's 64 years old. She had done this for years. She had had no problems. Well, she started reading about casualty losses and attempted claims and reimbursements, and she concluded that she could not claim a loss on the casualty loss until the year in which she finally, you know, settled with the insurer. Now, the tax court and the IRS disagreed in this case and pointed out that in reality, she really had no case back in 2007, so 2007 was the year she should have claimed the deduction, but she didn't. Rather, she had simply not filed in 2009 because she believed she had this huge loss, and so she had no tax liability and didn't need to file a tax return for 2009. She concluded that erroneously based on her understanding of the tax laws and her reading. Well, the tax court said, you know, we think she has reasonable cause for late filing. She said, this is different from somebody who maybe is a, you know, one of those people that think that the income tax is illegal, or one of those people that just simply never files and is looking for an excuse now for why they shouldn't be penalized. They said, no, she filed every year. It probably doesn't hurt the fact that not only did she file every year, but she actually didn't she's never claimed the loss on that 2007 fire, and she'll never be able to. So she doesn't get an advantage from this. When she was examined and the agent, you know, pointed out to her these rules, she immediately conceded she owed the tax. So she agrees she owes the tax. She agrees she owes the interest. She's paid it. The only thing she disagrees is that she should be penalized for late filing. The tax court found the taxpayer did enough here. She took reasonable steps to assess her tax liability. And because of that, we should not hold it against her that she happened to make the wrong answer. She wasn't somebody who, as we said, was always not filing, nor was she somebody who had, you know, set, you know, told her CPA or attorney to file an extension for me, because, by the way, we know we can't rely upon that. She had reasonably not properly understood a complex area of law. She had no reason to believe she wasn't capable of understanding that area of law. And so because of that, the court said it was reasonable for her not to file the return. So while she owes the tax, she owes the interest, she doesn't owe the penalty. She had reasonable cause for not filing her return. Well, as we know from our weekly updates, things are changing quite a bit here. And so it's important to know that the developments are going to keep coming. Be sure to check with your state CPA society for information about courses they have coming up and some of the important things that you might want to learn that you really need to keep up on, not just in taxes, but we've had changes in places like the overtime requirements that your clients probably want to be talking to you about that, about those issues. And you may need to know about them because if you're in the ANA side, that's a potential legal liability problem for them. There also have developments here in the ANA where we have the revenue recognition standard and the lease standard. All these things are things you should be keeping up with and that are more complicated than you're going to get from, let's say, a one-hour webinar on something or even, you know, some, you know, trying to read a self-study guide. You probably want to have a full eight-hour day when you can ask questions. Check your state societies. The state societies offer all kinds of high-quality, excellent courses that you can take in all of these areas to keep yourself up to speed and serve clients. So you don't get it wrong and your clients don't get it wrong. That helps everybody. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 22nd, 2016. We post updates during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Be sure to visit us there. You can also download a PDF with articles about all of today's updates at our website. So go to currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Go to the video and audio updates page. Get today's session. You'll see the PDF link there. If you have any questions, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at edzollers. Well, thanks for joining us this week, and be sure to watch next week and take and listen in as we take a look at our developments for the coming week in the area of federal taxes.